hear me first? Did this work? Yes. So it's difficult to start immediately after lunch. I will try to keep you awake, but if I see signs, it's difficult to mind read all these people distributed in this way in a room, so to know whether you sleep. But let's try to be your coffee. So I wanted to do different things with this talk, and one of the things was to summarize and synthesize a little bit what we know and what we would like to know or we don't know, and also discuss a little bit very, very shortly on how we might to move on to know better, both for gaining, acquire a better understanding of teaching and for better practice, which has been the starting point of our colloquy, which mixes these two points of view. I didn't want to use a PowerPoint, but at the last minute I decided to because of my English, which might not be clear for everybody, so you can follow on the slides. So the slides are quite written. So what do we know? Starting from the day before yesterday, we've started to see that we know something, but certainly not enough, about what we've called the teacher effect, the impact of teachers on students' achievements. What we do not seem to know, to have understood yet, is if this teacher effect exists and seems to be robust and long-lasting, which are the mechanisms which mediate between the teacher and the learner in order to produce this effect, and how, and this is in reference to this morning, session on the measures of this teaching effect, how to measure the teacher effect, the impact of teachers and of teaching on learners with measures that are less controversial than the ones such as teacher value added that have been introduced up to now, but also how to improve this effect globally. We've been talking about in-service training, but we've also been talking a lot about the difficulty of having, of spreading results of research and of having them adopted so that they can really and actually change education. What we don't know enough about, certainly, is what happens at the level of individual teachers, not as teachers as a profession, but individual teachers. What do they do before they become teachers? Why they do become teachers? How do they do as teachers? And what kind of cognitive skills allow them to be good or less good, but in any case, teachers. And I think many of you share this view with me, that there are some fundamental questions that are not only relevant for this place, for fundamental research, research on cognition or research on education, but that are also relevant for practice at the very same time. So the first question, I think, which is relevant for the two issue is how we teach. So which kind of cognitive mechanisms are involved in teaching, make teaching possible, not just effective, but possible, and this in the huge varieties of teaching that we've heard about during this two days and a half, teaching in children, teaching in different cultures, not just weird cultures, teaching among hunter-gatherers, but also teaching eventually among animals, teaching from adults to children, from children to children, from peers to peers. And how do these skills, which seems to be present in children from an early age, do they develop across ontogeny? And the second big question for me is the question of why we teach, which are the mechanisms, the causal mechanisms, both distal and proximate, both the functions of teaching, why teaching emerges, comes up at a certain moment during evolution, when, but also why, for serving which kind of functions does teaching appear And I think that the two questions are related, which are the motivations that day by day in our individual minds make teaching more or less a motivating activity and push us to teach in various situation environments, including to our children, not just to our pupils. So what do we know more or less, or what can we extract from the current literature about these two big questions? One of the things that when you start to swim in this literature, one of the first things that you notice is that there's this tendency to look at teaching as something that is very complex. And it certainly is. I mean, it's certainly true that a behavior that we can find in such a variety of situations, of ages, of kinds, taxa, it's certainly something very complex, something that deals with entire classrooms or in this situation with people I don't know, some I know. It's certainly a very complex behavior that we are putting in place. But at the same time, the fact that it is complex, even not just socially, institutionally, but even from a cognitive point of view, doesn't mean that we should not try to go deeper and also to go simpler, which is what natural sciences normally try to do with their very complex phenomena, which are observed on a daily basis around us, and we try to go deeper and deeper and deeper and to identify the smaller components and laws of these complex phenomena. So in the domain of teaching, the complex abilities, the complex skills that are normally evoked in order to explain how teaching is possible, how we teach, are normally mentalistic abilities, and we've discussed them a little bit, and even more than a little bit during these days. Abilities such as theory of mind, mind reading, which are both very, in itself, complex functions and even controversial functions, which is quite difficult to define precisely, and which require this deeper and simpler identification of components. At the opposite end of the spectrum of studies on teaching, still swimming in this literature, what do we find when we go on the other side of the ocean? Well, we find an approach which deals more with animal studies and animal teaching. We tend to undermine the interest of looking into the cognitive mechanism. So on the one side, you have very complex cognitive mechanisms. And on the other side, you have an approach, which is the functional approach to teaching, which says, okay, no, these functions are too complex. Come on, we cannot go and find them in animals. They won't be there. So the only way to study teaching in non-human animals is to provide a functional definition of teaching and to do without cognitive functions. So this approach, which had a huge interest and that has opened huge perspectives on the study of teaching, in my opinion, has the defect of throwing the baby with the bathwater. Since the cognitive abilities we have identified up to now are too complex, let's not search for cognitive abilities in animals that might make it possible to teach in non-human animals. So, others still swimming, okay? We're still, after the coffee, still swimming in this literature. What do we find? We find that these two opposite approaches, the cognitive approach to teaching and the, let's say, non-cognitive functional approach to teaching, have some difficulties in exchanging, in talking, and in integrating their views, which is not that surprising, seeing the premises, which means that today we lack an integrated view, a common theory of and a common definition of what teaching is. And another point, still swimming, another thing that we found is the lack of studies on and of documentation on the varieties of teaching. We've heard Barry Hewlett describing teaching, different forms of teaching in different societies. It was incredibly enriching, but unfortunately, when you swim, you need to swim a lot before you find an understudy and see the fish. So few studies for the moment in this domain which could give us a better image of what teaching is beyond our society and beyond these very artificial and very complex situations of teaching that we know that are the classrooms, with a relevant exception, which I invite you to read, a paper by Klein published in 2015, trying to provide a taxonomy of different forms of teaching. And last consideration, we find very, 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 very few here and swimming really a lot just for finding a rare pearl in the ocean of neuroscientific studies on teaching, while, as we were saying yesterday, we will probably find, it's what Sid saying, that millions of brain images of learning brains, but maybe we can count the images of teaching brains on the hands of one, of only one hand. So what is my objective today, and more generally as a philosopher of cognitive science dealing with these issues? I would say it is just paving the way for the identification of these neurocognitive mechanisms and requirements, what's needed in order to teach, that are necessary for teach, and to go as deeper and as simpler as possible. And this for both theoretical reason and understanding what teaching is and what's its role in nature, but also for very practical reasons, understanding what's the potential impact of teaching on practice and how to train, how to develop the capacities of teaching in those who do teach on a daily basis in our schools and beyond our schools. So I will have two proposals for paving this way. The first proposal, and we have been discussing a little bit during Sid's talk, is to, we have different choices. One choice is to go maximalistic and look at teaching in very complex situation. I would rather propose to go minimalistic and to go in search for the minimal building blocks of teaching, the neurocognitive building blocks, the most primitive, the most simple mechanisms, and how these simple mechanisms are involved in various forms of teaching, in highly complex teaching, but also in simpler forms of teaching. So the mechanisms that are common to every and single, if possible, variety of teaching behavior, and where to look for these kind of mechanisms in humans, of course, neurotypical humans, but not just neurotypical humans. We've been talking with some of you about the importance of studying pathologies of teaching or neuropathologies that can have an impact on the capacity of teaching in order to extract the capacity which is necessary for teaching as a magical pill in children and in adults, in various forms of relationship, horizontal, vertical relationships, oblique, and also across species, because as humans, we do teach to many animals, which are not of the same species as us, to do things that are interesting for us in weird and non-weird societies, as I was saying, and teaching with and without artifacts. I'm using an artifact. We often use artifacts while teaching. What's their role in teaching? Through symbolic and non-symbolic means, through language and other forms of demonstration, which do not necessarily require symbolic capacities. And of course, in non-human animals. I think that in this direction, this first proposal, the looking for the building blocks of teaching, we have a model, an example that we can follow. This morning I was talking about medicine as an example for translational research in education and cognitive science. I like to have models to follow, especially when they come first, so they can go wrong and we can learn from mistakes. So I think we have a good model here, which is numerical cognition, the studies that have been done in numerical cognition and which have led to identify for a very complex symbolic capacities, which are the precursors, which are the simpler building blocks which are present in newborn babies, in non-human species, including chicken, which are present from birth and leave a sort of signature, even when more complex, more symbolic capacities add on these first bases, which can be specifically impaired, or which can suffer from specific impairments in other domains. So I think this is a good guide. Try to do what our fellow colleagues in numerical cognition have done with numerical cognition can be a way to go in the domain of looking for these neurocognitive building blocks. So do we have some candidates to this very minimalistic search for the mechanisms that then can build up in more complex solutions, of course, or can mimic more complex solutions? Because we know that there are very simple mechanisms in nature which can be interpreted as very complex behavior, but in fact can be put in place with very few computations. So, always swimming in the literature, which is what philosophers do. Animal studies have revealed that there is something that is much more easier than to put in place than theory of mind or mind reading, and which enables some animals to teach, not just to teach in general, but to teach to specific animals which are in need of teaching. And I'm thinking about the studies on meerkats and on the fact that adult meerkats, identify their prey, identify the learner who's in need to learn because of vocal cues that the learner emits. When the voice of the learner, of the puppy, changes, mother or adult meerkats stop teaching in a certain way and adopts a different strategy. We say that this is a rigid form of teaching which doesn't adapt, is not as flexible as human teaching, but we cannot exclude that even in human teaching, in these complex things that we're doing every day, we still use some simpler mechanism, cue response mechanism like this, which trigger our teaching activity. So one of the objectives for a minimalistic search, for the search of building blocks in teaching, is seeing whether such simpler mechanism exists even in human teaching. And for this reason, we cannot dismiss too quickly the interest of animal studies and of evolutionary biology in order to better understand our behavior, even if it is the behavior of animals with a very complex culture, and nobody denies that. So other mechanisms that help setting the stage for teaching, this is our terminologies that have been used by Sid Strauss during this day, for setting the stage. So minimalistic forms of mind reading, precursors of mind reading, which some authors are trying to put in evidence to highlight, with a similar objective as the one I'm presenting, that is going deeper and finding the minimal building blocks of these complex capacities. Shared attention mechanisms, perspective taking, ostensive gestures, gaze prosody, all these are signals that have been studied on the side of the learner by the literature on natural pedagogy, but which deserve to be observed directly in order to dissect which of these mechanisms sets the stage for the kind of natural pedagogy reading mechanisms that have been hearing about yesterday. Several mechanisms that have been identified very early in the ontogenetic development of children, of the human species, and that help this process of information giving that have been described in children as young as 12 to 24 months, and that consist in pointing, in doing at the place of another, and we've seen it also in the video shown by Barry Hewlett yesterday, correcting or punishing the companion, the peer who's doing something which is not which doesn't follow the rule which the child has learned, or demonstrating and tolerating. These very simple forms of action which helps providing information to others, being described in children and in several cultures. What they do have in common, all these situations, and that I find really interesting for our search for the building blocks of teaching, is that in all these situations, what is given is not just information, even if we call them information-giving situations. It's also norms, values. All these situations are extremely normative and value-laden. Children do react to the fact that another child is not respecting the rules of the game, and they are prone to enforce norms and rules in others. They do not react positively when they see someone who's not playing with them, but who's not following the rule which has been given for a game or which has just been demonstrated by an adult. So in all this information giving or filling in the knowledge gap process, which is in place very early in the development of children and which is in place across culture, the part of normative, the normative aspect is extremely important, but I think we're not taking it enough into consideration when we are thinking about how we teach, but also when we think about the second question, that is, why we teach. And most of the situations that we've been hearing about during this day, and most of the situations I am describing here, the baby pointing in order to help the adult to find or to find the object is not finding, or to close to find the object in the closet, or to put the shape in the right place. All these early information giving situations are normally described as being altruistic situation, as the information giving terminology, suggests. There's something that is given to others, that is taken away from me and given to others in a very altruistic gesture of sharing something in a way that is costly for me and it has an advantage for you. This is the framework in which teaching is normally thought about in this literature that we have up to now. So, and this altruistic term is incredibly present in both the opposite directions I was describing at the beginning, the opposite views of teaching, the cognitive approach, the non-cognitive functional approach. If there is just one thing that they do have in common, these two approaches, is to define teaching as an altruistic behavior through which the teacher, costly, with no immediate advantage for him or herself, does in order to, intention, or so as that the learner has an advantage. What hits me is that the very possibility that there are selfish reasons and selfish mechanisms behind teaching, both far away, evolutionary reasons and mechanisms for the evolution of teaching behavior in humans and other animals, and at the level of the motives that motivate as humans teaching daily, this very possibility of selfish mechanisms is simply skipped off. And I'm not saying that teaching has only selfish mechanisms, but I would like to take them in serious consideration as much as we do take in serious consideration altruistic mechanisms. And maybe a possible explanation why selfish mechanisms are so ignored in the domain of teaching is that teaching, we'll look at it much more in the sense of information giving than in its dimension of a behavior that creates social bonds, passes or enforces norms, values, creates a sharing situation where we do not just share information, but we share trust, we share prestige, we share social characters and motives that go beyond the simple information giving or the helping doing better tools. So the second proposal that I have in this search for the cognitive and neurocognitive building blocks of teaching is to try to look also at teaching per se. So try to identify the social roles of teaching that might have this, both this ultimate and proximate role in explaining the development and the evolution of teaching. And there are several self-serving interests that we might want to look at and that might reveal to be to play a role in the evolution, in the development, and in the performance of teachers. Manipulating and influencing others, we have some evidence that even in animals, some forms of social learning do have maladaptive outcomes for the learner who follows the teacher even if is influenced by the teacher, even if it is not at his immediate advantage. Teachers may gain prestige and do gain prestige from this costly act of giving information to others or providing knowledge and skills of sharing. And prestige can have advantages. And there are some studies on the opposite side, that is on how learners do choose their teachers in reason because of the prestige of these teachers. But we should have also the opposite studies on what kind of prestige do teachers gain by teaching, because of teaching, and what kind of advantages do they have? Other advantages can be that of establishing dominance without violence, by teaching, by sharing norms, enforcing norms and values in a non-violent ways. And there are some studies on children in schoolyards gaining prestige and dominance by teaching, by giving information to others, but without bullying them. And as we've heard by Uri yesterday, why not looking for the less dark side of teaching, the brighter side of teaching, of motives which are just those of creating sort of couplings, of resonating individuals and taking pleasure in this, in establishing this communication and this assonance between individuals. And finally, and we've heard that through Seed, but unfortunately very, very few studies have been done on that, maybe teaching provides to teachers also cognitive advantages. The fact of teaching might help learning better and more easily. And all this is not implausible as far as learners are not just passive receivers of what teachers do provide, but can avoid being exploited because they possess mechanisms that help them in this direction. And we've heard yesterday Kathleen Corriveau talking about selective trust. And I think that we will hear you talking more about trust and the mechanisms that make us capable of judging who's the good teacher, but also what kind of teacher we want to follow, and to evaluate whether the information given is honest or dishonest. And I think that we have there too some models that can inspire this search, this reflection on teaching per se, which come from evolutionary biology and in particular from studies from the theory and the approach of the coevolution of signaling systems in senders and receivers at the benefit of both, which has been described as an arms race of developing mechanisms for sending and for receiving information, which is useful for both the sender and both the receiver. So let's not forget that teaching can have evolved for serving the teacher, still having benefits for the learner who develops mechanisms for exploiting the information given by the teacher. But at the same time, we should not forget that teaching can have maladaptive outcomes for the learner. And I think that in some, we wanted to discuss it today if Scott Atran had come for the conclusions, that we should also take into account what happens when some forms of teaching go wrong and what kind of maladaptive behavior can be learned to teaching, which is what I call the dark side of teaching. So I think that starting from this, we can arrange a definition of teaching that is neutral to complex functions and to altruism, both, as a system for pushing mental contents, specific forms of mental contents, generalizable information, knowledge, norms, ways of doing into other minds, eventually influencing their behaviors in a way that enhances the chances of success of these contents in a cultural way, with effects that are both at the level of social relations and can have potential benefits for both sides. So I think there are consequences of this very, very theoretical approach to teaching, potential consequences for the practice of teaching that come from gaining a better understanding of these very basic aspects, very fundamental aspects of teaching. I think that if we can identify the building blocks of teaching, what makes teaching natural, the natural basis of teaching, we are in a better position to identify the situation in which teaching can go wrong, because the distance is too big between the artificial conditions, the cultural conditions in which we teach, the complex content that we do teach, and the natural basis that we do have. So by measuring this distance, we can understand which situations will create greater difficulties for teaching, and also we will manage to find the strategies for overcoming or just for avoiding these difficulties, as we've heard this morning, maybe with the help of some technologies which can take in charge a part of the difficulties created by the huge development of our culture, which has made our content so difficult to pass and which has created conditions for passing these contents and norms and values that are so distant from those which are part of our evolutionary past. So we should ask ourselves, are the conditions for identifying the pedagogical cues that babies use, for instance, when learning from others, are these conditions met in our modern classes? Are the conditions for sharing attention between the teacher and the learner met in this teaching situation? Or it is too much for the teacher to try to share attention with 40 people at the same time? Are the conditions for the information retrieval from the mind of the teacher too complicated? Are we in a cognitive overload all the time while teaching, which makes it difficult and inefficient to teach in these conditions? And so on and so forth. And I think that even what seems more theoretical, understanding why we teach, why teaching has evolved, can be useful, because it can help us dealing with more realistically with the functions of teaching, which I am convinced are not limited to information giving and information passing, but are more deeply rooted in social bonds, relations, and the norms and values of different contents. So I will conclude on this consideration, which we have discussed at many different points during these 3 days. So that's what we know. That's what we would like to know. So how we go from here to there? Simple problem solving. How do we do better? How do we know better about teaching? And I don't think that we can skip fundamental research on building blocks. But at the same time, and I don't think that we can skip the other element that we've discussed so much, which is having more evidence, not just evidence as knowledge about teaching as a function, but evidence about what happens in the classes, evidence about which are the training in service methods which work better. These two components are very important, but will not be enough. And this morning, the big word has come out, and I think it is it's a crucial word if we want to use fundamental knowledge to enhance practice, and the word is adoption. I think that we should really set up conditions for translational research as they exist in medicine, where the first question that is asked is, if we have new knowledge, how do we favor its adoption by practitioner? How do we create situations in which practices can really change and be transformed by knowledge? So, develop translational research in this domain is not easy. It demands institutions, it demands several forms of organizations, researchers, applied researchers, is a new system of thinking about not just teaching, but about education in general. And the last and really last thing is, I don't think we can do miracles. Teaching in our society is like doing science. We become better and we develop tools, artifacts, diagrams, technologies, accelerators, which help us going deeper and going simpler. But science remains difficult to do and difficult to learn because at some level it is natural and at some level it is unnatural for our brains. And I think that teaching is much more in the same position as science. It will always be difficult. We will never be completely satisfied with teaching, but teaching works like science. And our objective is making it better, not making it the best ever. Thank you.